The music of Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers. Welcome to another episode of Out the Rabbit Hole here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Robert Larson. This is our January 19th, 2012 edition of the show, 4:08 p.m. on the clock here in Irvine, California. Before we get fully underway, I have a couple of quick reminders for you. First of all, the opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the KUCI staff or management or the UC Board of Regents. And if you want to give me some feedback on the show, I always appreciate that. You can email me at rglarson@kuci.org. You can also catch me on Facebook. That's facebook.com/rglarson. The late 70s, early 80s L.A. punk music scene is something hard to understand if you weren't there. Those who were there, who can convey it to those who weren't, are in possession of some sacred yet profane skill. Such is the case with our guest today, Iris Berry. With poetry and prose, she masterfully elucidates that alarming time, as well as other aspects of life, her life, that fed into and grew out of it. It's moving, gritty, honest, and straight shooting right between the eyes or the legs or right in the chest. As well as these writing talents and her L.A. original punk scene street cred, Iris is also an actress, musician, L.A. historian in general, and Mexican wrestling ring girl. Her work is featured in several books, including The Outlaw Bible of American Poetry, How Dirty Girls Get Clean, and Five Femme Fatale Poets. Two Blocks East of Vine is a book entirely of her poetry. Iris co-authored The Underground Guide to Los Angeles with Pleasant Gemin, with whom she also co-founded the Ringling Sisters. And if you want to see Ms. Berry in film, check out Border Radio, Kill House, or I Pass for Human. Iris Berry, welcome to the show.
Hi, Robert. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Been looking forward to this for a while. And, I just kind of recently discovered your work, and I was like, wow, this is all the kinds of things that I'm interested in or things that are part of my past as well. And she does quite a job of conveying what that was about, and some of it which I didn't know personally, but a lot of which I did. So, yeah, it's really great to have you.
Thank you. It's really great to be here. It doesn't get any more pirate radio than this.
I enjoy what we can do here. So anything I left out of the intro there, I must have, because you've done so much. Anything you want to mention really quickly?
I'm also, working, Pleasant Game and I are also working on another project called Notes from a Punk Rock Crash Pad, which is a series of shows where, we have people reading from back in the day notes, literally notes from Punk Rock Crash Pad. And we'll be doing another show. We're planning another show in May, maybe the end of April. And eventually we'll be doing an anthology.
Okay. And anybody listening now, they can find out about all of your work. You have a Facebook page, a web page. Want to give out those addresses to us right now?
Sure. The webpage is irisberry.com. The Facebook page is irisberry5 at, Facebook. And then I have also a like page for my writing, which is also, you can just put my name in and it'll come up, Iris Berry. There's also a page for Notes from a Punk Rock Crash Pad, which is also a like page on Facebook. And both of those have Twitter pages, and I just launched a new press on Friday the 13th with A Razor called Punk Hostage Press. We have a Twitter page, and we have a blog spot. We also have a like page under that name, Punk Hostage Press, on Facebook.
Okay, great. And we'll give out that information once more before we end the show today. But yes,
phone book.
I've been thoroughly transfixed by reading your work. And even though those times were sort of more real than real. Some of it seems unbelievable, almost giving it a dreamlike quality, even though...
What do you mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like... I guess I lived some of the similar types of things, not all to the degree that you convey in your work, but it's like these things were so intense, these happenings back then, and you know it happened because it was so intense, but at the same time, yeah. It seems like, how could it have happened? Does that make sense, what I'm saying there?
I think while it was happening, we didn't realize, I knew what was going on was pretty amazing, but at the same time, I didn't have anything else to compare it to. I didn't have now to compare it to. I just knew that our life everything was just happening so naturally. There was a window of time, and that was back at that time where everybody just sort of, we all met in such a really organic fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody just sort of found each other, and with all the right chemistry musically, for in the music scene and the punk scene, Pleasant Gaiman and I just we accidentally met, and we met at we would always just run into each other. We met when I was working at the 01 After Hours Club, and just these relationships just formed, and it really was so natural. There was nothing to question. We just literally rolled out of bed into rehearsal, rolled out of bed into a show, rolled out of bed into writing songs, rolled out of bed and, occasionally went to work. And our jobs were also in the middle of it all. So, and everything, especially when Pleasant and I lived at Disgraceland, which is our punk rock crash pad that we were writing about, or one of them, everything was in a few block radius of what we needed. We didn't need a car.
Yeah.
We lived in the shadow of the sign, the Fredericks of Hollywood sign, in the shadow of the Hollywood sign, just south of Hollywood Boulevard. So we could just walk everywhere, and everybody else was there. It was amazing. All the clubs were there. All the stores we had to go to were there. Red Brook Books was there. Book City. It was incredible. It really was.
Yeah, I was involved with some of this, not to the degree that you were, but so I remember at the time, yeah, you just lived it, and it was just what you did. It was something to do, and it seemed fun and exciting, and it was. And but it's just, yeah, when you look back on it now, sometimes I have the, did that really happen? It's kind of like that to me. And I catch that a little bit with your, not that you're saying that, but when I read what you're chronicling, I'm, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So when did you realize that you could touch people with written words and that you should be a chronicler of some of this life, this crazy life?
Well, I started writing when I was 7, and it was just something that kind of was a great outlet for me because I was born in Burbank at St. Joseph's Hospital, so I'm a native, and my family lived in Pacoima, and that was a really heavy gang area. I had 3 older brothers, and we lived by this park called Branford Park. And I just felt so much different than everybody, and I would just go in my room and write at 7. And then when I was about 10, my mom came to me, and she said, "I found all your writing, and I spoke to your teacher, and if you write 50 more, we can publish you as a young writer." And suddenly what I was doing that was so personal, I felt a little bit violated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I felt really shocked, and it was just such a...
Okay, plagued by a little bit of technical difficulties here on Out the Rabbit Hole, KUCI in Irvine. So we went back to a little more Heartbreakers music there. But yeah, getting back with our special guest today, Iris Berry. Iris, we got you back on the board here.
Hi.
Okay. I don't know if we, we're doing this interview by cell phone today. We're going to have you in studio, and then just a lot of things intervened, and so we're making do here. And yeah. The sound quality was good, but I guess we just had a little dropout, as will happen with cell phones sometimes. So let's get back to it. Where did we leave off at?
Basically, you're asking me when I started writing, and so I started at 7, and, you know, I got threatened with being published, stopped writing altogether. And then when I was around, you know, 21 and I was living in West Hollywood by the Whiskey A Go-Go, I sort of stumbled into the West Hollywood Library. And I was looking under the B section going, if I ever get published, where will my books be? Who am I going to be next to? And I found a book by a guy by the name of Charles Bukowski, and a book by the name of a guy by the name of Charles Baudelaire. Mm. And I checked both of those out, and they changed my life. I never read such beautiful writing, and Charles Bukowski really let me know that I could have my own voice, and I didn't have to rhyme, which was really big news to me as a poet. And also, Baudelaire, the title of the book was called Fleurs de Mal, which means Flowers of Evil, which is pretty much what my idea of poetry was, and was also how Charles Bukowski, how he was writing, you know, really defining the beauty in everything, in all of it, and the humanity and the insanity and all that. And so I started writing again, but I'm still keeping it really private. And then my roommate at the time and boyfriend, my roommate Pleasant Gaiman, we were living at Disgrace, and my boyfriend at the time was Dave Alden. They both were going, you know, my journals were just sort of laying around, and they both started going through my journals, and Pleasant started showing Dave, you know, a few things, going, look at this, and look at that, and Dave was like, what is this? And I was like, well, it's just something I'm just my writing. And he's like, Iris, you have to write. You need to go public. Mm-hmm. And between the two of them, they forced me to go public. And Dave had a book coming out, Nana, Big Joe, and the 4th of July, and he had Pleasant and I opened for him at the Lhasa Club. And that was kind of the beginning of it. They both forced me to go public. And then Pleasant and I started making our own chapbooks, printing them at Kinko's, printing them at my work after hours, using the Xerox machine and, you know, pasting them up, you know, cutting out our own photos and pasting them up. And then we'd go into the bars like the Frolic Room and the Firefly, and we'd sell our books for drinks and money and, you know, and we'd do poetry readings. And it happened really naturally. It was just... And it was really, people were like, what are you doing? And we're like, we're making our own books. And they're like, how are you doing that? And we're like, we're just doing it. So that led to the Ringling Sisters. Gary Eaton, who was the guitar player in the Devil Squares, he read 56 Reasons, which was in the chapbook, mine and Pleasant's first chapbook, and just titled The Ringling Sisters. And, he said, wow, can I put music to this? And that was a piece that Dave Alden and I wrote about some friends of ours that were getting carried away on drugs. And he put it to music, and then he got a piece that Pleasant wrote called Kimberly Rose, and he put music to that. And the next thing you know, we had a bunch of songs, and we pulled in some other girls, and Jeanette Napolitano, Texacella Jones, Debbie Dexter, Annette Zelinskas from Blood on the Saddle.
Wow, these are some great names.
We had an Insta band. It was... Again, it just happened really, really naturally.
And so, yeah, the Ringling Sisters, and that's been, how long did that happen for? Or is it still happening?
Well, it sort of kept happening. It would happen in different waves. Like, first of all, we started out, and literally, we were barely together, and at that time, punk had sort of meshed into metal, and metal was sort of reigning supreme, and we were so not that, and we would do a song and some spoken word in between the song on stage, and we had a full band on stage with all kinds of things going on, and, you know, people were like, what are you doing? I would be like, I don't know, but we're just doing it. The next thing you know, we get a call from Lou Adler planning to come and see us because I think he probably thought we were kind of close to the Mamas and the Papas, which was one of his, you know, one of his bands,
right.
One of his many, you know, huge endeavors. So that led into a record deal with A&M Records and a recording, which was called 60 Watt Reality, which is was a piece that I wrote that Jimmy, Top Jimmy, actually that was his title, Top Jimmy.
Yeah, Top and Jimmy and the Rhythm
Singer
Pigs.
The Rhythm Pigs, yeah, and that was his title. And I wrote a poem about 60 Watt Reality, and they named and that's how the record starts. And Lou named the record 60 Watt Reality. So that happened, and then, you know, the record company sort of went upside down, and all the record companies got eaten up by other record companies, and the band sort of imploded. And then in around 93, Pleasant and myself and Annette Zelenskis reformed a different version of the Ringling Sisters, a more lounge version.
Mm.
And we did that for a while. And we along with our performances, we would do the annual Christmas benefits, which was a huge community get together, a lot of bands. We'd get a lot of bands together. And we started doing them at Raji, moved over to the Roxy because Lou Adler was part owner of the Roxy. We ended up at the Palace, and there was, you know, there would be all kinds of acts, Cor La Pandit, Jim Carroll, Henry Rollins, Hubert Selby, 7 Year Bitch, the Ringling Sisters, the Coma Jones, Davey Allen, X, the Blasters, the Knitters, Screamin' Jay Hawkins.
Some amazing names there. Just,
yeah,
great
just
talent.
So many, Charlie Sexton, so many different, the last ever show of the Gun Club, they did their last show.
And these were all benefit shows?
These were all benefits, and the proceeds went to the Holly Grove Children's Orphanage, went to Children of the Night, went to Project Angel Food. I have, you know, we did a PIP, which is People in Progress, which is a treatment center in Sun Valley. It started with one charity, which was called the Holly Grove Children's Orphanage in Hollywood. And then every year as the benefits got bigger, we would start spreading the proceeds around.
Yeah, wow, great stuff. This is Out the Rabbit Hole, KUCI in Irvine, Robert Larson here. And I'm speaking with Iris Berry, and we're talking about all of her wonderful work. And Iris is a writer and poet and musician, actress, done all kinds of amazing things, worked with all kinds of amazing people. And I love the story you told about how your poetry just all came together, and you were writing stuff that your mom found, and then you had a journal, and your roommate Pleasant saw it, and Dave Alvin was your boyfriend at the time, and then it was just like, oh, and, you know, Pleasant was just somebody you met or accidentally, and you know, all this just came together, and it's just like, wow, you have to be write this stuff. And you mentioned 56 Reasons to Go Downtown. Could you read that one now? I love that one.
Thank you. That's the one that Dave Alvin and I wrote.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You just say when, and I would love to.
Let's go.
Okay. All right. This is called 56 Reasons to Go Downtown. And it's perfect timing. You can tell what we were just listening to. All right. Johnny Thunders did it because Lenny Bruce did it. Honey did it, too, because Art Pepper did it. He did it because Charlie Parker did it. Look at Keith Richards. I'm a sensitive artist, too. Yeah, I'm a rebel, and the scene's really dead. And I can't afford to go to Europe this summer. And I want to buck the fitness kick. And private property is really an outmoded concept. Because I like hanging out in pawn shops. Because I like losing friends and meeting scum. Anyway, it's all society's fault. You know, Darby Crash, Sid and Nancy. Look, your boyfriend does it. Your girlfriend does it. If I want to sleep on the bathroom floor, if I want to sleep in my breakfast, if I want to sleep in my dinner, and if I want to die watching TV, it's my business. And besides, I've got it all under control. I do it only twice a week at the most. So quit hassling me. It's rock and roll. It's the Rolling Stones. And didn't Edie Sedgwick look so cool in Chow Manhattan? She was out on the edge, and I like being out on the edge. Just like Burroughs. Just like Thunders. Yeah, Johnny Thunders did it. Look, I know I'm propping up third world dictatorships, but I'm not hurting anyone else. So quit hassling me. I've got it all under control.
Yeah, yeah. Great, really. That's powerful. In you and Dave Alvin wrote that together?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
And that's another one of those things that just sort of blowed out.
Yeah, and some of these things, I know a lot of times when you write these things, a lot of kind of working it out and thought goes into it, but some things just really flow out of you really quickly, and that this was more of that type, right?
Uh-huh. That's what I call winning the lottery, when they just flow out like that.
Yeah.
They sort of just have to come right out. They come through you, and they have to come out. And I love when that happens.
Yeah, I think it was Townes Van Zandt, I think, was talking about that one time and talking about how when that happens, you just have to be there. You have to be in the right spot at the right time and catch that little wave. You know, it's like a surfer catching the perfect wave, and you just go with it. And yeah, so, but you obviously were around a lot of this kind of stuff and people using, and it's heavy duty. I mean, I don't know. What can you say to people who haven't been around that kind of thing at all?
It's painful. It's painful on both ends, you know. It's painful, you know. I mean, I've been on both sides of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, it's no joke, and it's nothing to mess around with, and I really believe that addiction is, I don't think it's something people go out and choose to do. It's mm-hmm. something, it's just, it's really, it's definitely an epidemic, in epidemic proportions, and I work a little bit in that field in treatment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still involved. I'm, like I said, I've been on both sides. It's funny because after Dave and I wrote that, you got to be careful what you write, I got to tell you, because it could end up biting you in the butt, and you know, it bit me, and I just really am so, I feel really hopeful for the kids these days, because there's so much more awareness now, and at that time there wasn't as much.
Yeah.
There wasn't hardly any.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's treatment, and it's good, and it works. It really does.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned Johnny Thunders in there, and we played some of his music, and you know, Johnny Thunders was a great artist, and we all loved his work, and there was definitely a coolness about him, but it wasn't, you know, being a junkie wasn't what made him cool.
No.
That was just something that he did. And, you know, I think a lot of people, like, they want to emulate these kinds of people, and it's like, well, yeah, you know, emulate his guitar playing and his swagger and all this and that, but, you know, that's something that, you see where it ended with him.
Oh my God, yeah. Live by the sword, die by the sword. It was, you know, he didn't, it's still questionable how he really died, but either way, it was a direct result of how he was living.
Yeah, it fed into that for sure.
And yeah.
It's, did you ever get to meet him?
Yes, I did, actually, a few times. And, you know, he was definitely a character, and but you know, I think it would have been amazing had he have gotten off drugs and lived, and became even more in charge of, you know, his life. And I think, I really believe he still had so much in him. He was so talented.
Mm.
I really believe. Yeah, drugs. He was that whole junkie chic thing, but I would have loved to seen him clean and hear what kind of songs he wrote.
Yeah, I know. And it
would have been amazing.
Yeah, he definitely was a talent and could, you know, just pull that great riff and just style and swagger and had all that, you know. So it's
I know.
But, yeah, can you read another one for us really quickly,
oh, I'd love
Iris?
To.
Yeah, and we're speaking with Iris Berry today, and she's a poet as well as doing many other things, and but I really like her poems a lot, so that's why we're focusing on a couple of these. The other one I really liked a lot was I Am the Bastard Child, I think. Is that the title?
Yes, yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, you know, what we were just talking about, that whole the concept of cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool can kill. That's really what I ended up realizing in the end, that it can kill people.
And you saw it up close and personal.
Yeah, and people get trapped in that whole thing of wanting to stay cool, and it's, you know, at the end of the day, where did it, how cool are you when you're in a motel room and you're dead and people are robbing you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sadly.
Yeah. It's right, and it's and then I don't get it. I don't get from you that this is like you're being judgmental or anything. It's more
no.
like this is reality. This is reality, and this is like, you know, I know people do this, and some people don't do it, and some people pull through it, and it's not like you're a bad person. It's just like this is a dangerous thing, and let's just be very honest and straight up about what we're dealing with here. Is
right.
That, yeah.
And I struggled a lot with writing about it because I didn't want to send a bad message to the kids, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to send a bad message to my peers. And it's always a hard thing for me to write about because people are like, well, you should really write about a lot about that stuff. But I know that it's sending a message and that's not the message I want to send. And you're right. It's not a judgment. I'm not judging anyone for having a disease of addiction,
mm-hmm.
at all. There's no judgment. There's more compassion than anything. But the good news is that there is a way out. And
right.
Nowadays, there are so many opportunities. There's really a lot of help out there. So if anyone is in trouble, you know, help is really close by.
Right. And then, you know, people are going to take that to heart from you, somebody who's been around this, who's somebody who knows it, somebody who's seen people die, and they know it's not BS when you're talking, and this comes through quite clearly in some of your poems and your other writings, and so I, you know, kudos for that, you know, a lot of respect for that.
Thank you. It's no joke.
No.
And so, thanks.
Yeah, so could you read that other one for us, I Am the Bastard
yes.
Child?
Okay, I'm ready when you are. You ready?
Let's go.
Okay, I am the bastard child. I'm not my mother's daughter, or for that matter, my father's either. I am the bastard child of Jack Kerouac, Jack Daniels, and Jack Spratt. I am the lost, illegitimate love child of the ages, and I suffer at the altar of humanity or something close to it. I've given up on perfection, and whether you think it's right or not. I've given up on all the whores and all my heroes, living and dead. And I apologize beyond the solar system for trying to hold them to the job of my demise and my rescue. I am not my mother's daughter. I am her sister. I am not even my father's daughter. I am his wife. I am the bastard child. And all those who have gone before me, who have loved too much, too little, or not at all, and were crippled by it.
Ah, thank you. Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, that, those who love too much, too little, or not at all, I mean, that, it, to me, it says so much, and that is just, that defines so much of what goes on in so many of our lives, of just, you know, we've seen that, the people that just love too much, and it just Fs them over, and the people that, you know, not at all, and they build
right.
up the stone wall.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've all been around all of that, some of us very right in our families, some of, you know, ourselves, And it's just, life is not easy.
Well, loving ourselves is probably one of the hardest things to do. And that's kind of the deal. It's just loving. And it sounds so corny, you know, like something you'd read on a bumper sticker or, you know, but it's really, that's at the end of the day, that's really the deal. Because if, you know, and I don't mean that in a narcissist, I come first kind of way, because, you know, it's really about giving back, and, you know, everything has to start with, like, being, showing up to give. But it, and that's kind of the math. If you show up to give, and not in a way to get, but show up just to really genuinely give, that is a form of self-love, you know, it's a form of integrity, and, you know, so, but it's tricky business. It really is, loving yourself.
Mm-hmm. And I think all of that ties in with these issues of addiction and as far as the loving too much or not enough or not feeling the love. And this is, I think, that's so interrelated to problems of addiction.
So. Absolutely. And these days with the internet, you know, I mean, it's out of control. I was just talking to my partner Razor, who I started the press with, Punk Hostage Press, and because, you know, with our press, we're really trying to keep the book alive. That's kind of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
We really want to keep, you know, we're not against the e-books, but we don't want to see books die. So, and he and I were talking about how it's really important. It's really great that we're doing this press, but we really, it has to be a nonprofit, and we really, with the money that we make off of it, we want it to go to various charities and helping people that are in trouble, whether it's addiction or domestic violence or, you know, illness. We want to be able to create more awareness with the press, and also put out some literature at the same time, so we can keep it feeding itself, and it's not just in vain.
Yeah. Well, great stuff. And what's the contact info for that? Is it a website on?
It's, well, right now, well, yeah, there's the website's under construction. It's going to be punkhostagepress.com, and there's a blog spot, and there's the Twitter page, which is punkhostagepress at Twitter, and there's the like page on Facebook, which is Punk Hostage Press.
Okay.
Everything we're just launching it now.
Okay, and that'll we'll be looking forward to that. This is Out the Rabbit Hole, KUCI in Irvine. Robert Larson here, and I'm speaking today with Iris Berry, writer, poet, actress, musician, sex columnist. Didn't you do that for a while?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Forbidden fruit.
Okay, and I did want to ask you about this, though. There were all these amazing places back in the day, and I don't know. I hung out at the legendary Mask and some of these other places. I think the Zero One, and you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to admit that I never hung out at the notorious Tropicana Motel.
So. oh my God, it's a tragedy. And that's one of the places where I saw Johnny Thunders. That's one of the places where I met Stu Bader. Everybody was there. Amazing.
Yeah, so you wrote something about that, and you put together a piece actually where all of these other celebrity people put in their two cents of what it was like. And so tell us a bit about this crazy place.
Tropicana Motel was on Santa Monica Boulevard, in between, right down the street from the Troubadour, basically. And it was the West Coast version of the Chelsea Hotel in New York, where all the artists lived and stayed and partied. And it basically, the management really encouraged it instead of stopped it. It was unbelievable. There were bungalows in the back. It was basically a poolside motor inn with AstroTurf. And the pool was painted black, so you couldn't see, like, the floating syringes and lawn chairs, and there was all, God only knows what was really in that pool, but, on any given day, you would run into the Dead Boys, you would run into Levi and the Rock Cats, you'd run into Elvis Costello, or George Thorogood. Tom Waits lived in the in one of the bungalows in the back for like 5 years, and him and Chucky Weiss lived back there, and Ricky Lee Jones. And in the early 60s, Jim Morrison hung out there a lot.
Mm.
And at that time, Sandy Koufax owned it. Sandy Koufax from the Dodgers.
Yay.
So it was called Sandy Koufax. Yeah, yay, baseball. And it was called Sandy Koufax's Tropicana Motel. And he owned it for a while. Did you know that?
Yeah, I read that in what you had written. And by the way, I just throw this out there. Today, I think it is the 40th anniversary of Sandy Koufax being inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame at a younger age than anybody. So just put that.
Oh, my God. How old was he?
35 or something. Not very old.
Wow.
Yeah. Most people are still playing at that age. He'd already been out of baseball for a few years. Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah. So the 40th anniversary, so that was 72?
I guess that would be it, yeah.
So that was after the Tropicana. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, so he bought it around 64 and tried that for a while. And I think at that time, Gene Autry, who owned the Anaheim Angels, I believe Gene Autry was investing in the Hyatt House. So it was kind of an interesting rivalry going on there between those two. And, the Tropicana, at that point, before it was a rock star hangout, it was this haven for character actors to go and kind of stay under the radar and live at a reasonably priced motel. And right around the time Chuck Weiss and Tom Waits moved in there, which was in the mid-70s, it was $6 a night. And basically, Chucky Weiss moved down here from Colorado, and Tom Waits was living in Silver Lake. And he said to Chucky, I know this great place. We can get eggs and hash browns and toast and bacon and, that really, really good food. And it's under this motel. And they used to drive there every day to go eat breakfast. And it was under the motel. The restaurant was Duke's.
Mm.
Where, it was family style. So wherever you were sitting, you didn't know who you'd be sitting next to. But they had these really long tables, and everybody was just sort of thrown together in a very New York style kind of way. And it was loud, it was busy, it was greasy, it was good, the food was good. And they used to drive there every day, and finally Chucky was like, this place is $6 a night, why don't I just move in here? So Chuck moved there, and then Tom moved in there right after him, because he would come and see Chuck all the time. And after a while, I think they raised the rent to $9, so they literally just flipped the sign over. And there's a lot of great stories. I'm working on a book, and Slate, the issue of Slate number one, that you have a copy of, there are some great excerpts from Anthony Kiedis, Legs McNeil, Jerry Stahl, great anecdotes, Cheetah Chrome from the Dead Boys, Jimmy Zero from the Dead Boys, B.B. Puel, who met Elvis Costello there. And, those are just some of the excerpts that I've collected for this book.
And
I'll be really happy to get it finished.
Yeah, and just the things in those little stories there that happened, people were talking about anything seedy you can imagine was going on there, and some things maybe you can't even imagine, and just... I'm waiting for somebody to make a movie of it.
I know. Well, hopefully after... Yeah, me too. But that's where all the after parties were. You'd go there, and there would be a gig, there'd be a show at the Troubadour or the Whiskey, and the band was inevitably staying at the Tropicana. So the after party was at the Tropicana, and everybody's doors were open, and people just went from room to room, and God only knows when and how long you'd been there when you woke up.
And speaking of making movies, you've been in a few films. What can you tell us about that?
Oh, I just did a part in Allison Anders' Strutter, which is the third movie of the Border Radio trilogy, which was her first film with Kurt Voss. And actually, she and Kurt Voss are are doing Strutter as well, and we filmed it up at Pappy and Harriet's in Joshua Tree. And I got to play myself, actually.
Oh,
I played myself, and I read a little piece, a little spoken word piece, and then I went back to being the bartender and in the movie, and I had a heart-to-heart with the lead character about how he really needs to get his life together. Mm-hmm. And that was really fun, and I was in Beth Dewey's Kill House, and I had a little teeny cameo in the Casserole Club, Steve Balderson's Casserole Club, and that was really great. I was in Christie's I Passed for Human, Christie, who is the singer for the Flesh Eaters, and I was in also the documentary, The Making of the Casserole Club. And, God, I don't even know anymore. There's so many.
Well, yeah, I'm going to have to check out some of these films.
Really,
and I love these independent films. And I just
And Bob and the Monster. I was in the documentary about Bob Forrest.
Okay.
That just came out. And Bob, who was the singer for Thelonious Monster,
mm-hmm.
and Bicycle Thief, Kirda Baruth and Rick Ballard just did an incredible documentary on Bob Forrest, and I'm in it, and a bunch of other people are in it, Anthony and Flea and the guys from Fishbone, and, you know, Dave Navarro, and just a bunch of friends of Bob's are in it, and it's got a lot of great footage from back in the day.
Wow.
A lot of great footage from Raji's and Thelonious Monster on tour. Really so heartwarming. Such a great film.
All right. So, yeah, and they can find out all of these things that you've been part of. And I think the best place to go really is your Facebook page has a really great bio on there and lists all these things you've been involved with. Is that the best place to...
That's a good place, my writer page. But also you can go to my IMDb page, too, and you can find all the movie stuff. But the bio's on the writer, the Iris Berry writer page.
Okay, it's Iris Berry, and that's Berry, as in Chuck.
No relation.
And but anyway, yeah, so we don't have too much time left here. I want to touch on one thing while we still have a few minutes left, and that you mentioned Pappy and Harriet's, and you also wrote this piece about this funky, really cool place out in Desert Hot Springs. So you obviously have this love for... L.A.'s next-door neighbor, the desert. And, if you could talk a little bit about just hanging out in the desert and maybe that crazy place in Desert Hot Springs.
Yeah, wow. I do love the desert. I really do. And whether it's Joshua Tree or Las Vegas, I just love the desert air and Desert Hot Springs. And we filmed Casserole Club in Desert Hot Springs. And The picture of me on the cover of How Dirty Girls Get Clean, hugging the typewriter, that was taken at a place called the Beat Motel, which was a tip of the hat to the Beat Motel, the Beat Hotel in Paris, which was where all the expatriates lived and wrote and painted, and all the artists were there in the... in the 20s and the 30s. And then the Beats came there in the 50s. Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs, Gregory Corso, Jack Kerouac. And actually, Gregory Corso, it didn't have a name. It was just an address. And Gregory Corso, nicknamed it the Beat Hotel, and it stuck. So everyone, you know, that's what it was called, the Beat Hotel. And Steve Lowe, the owner of the Beat Motel in Desert Hot Springs, he was William Burroughs' assistant in the 50s. And he decided to open the Beat Motel in Desert Hot Springs. And in this motel, this beautiful motel, every room, you know, it wasn't just your average motel. The desk in the corner was the desk that William Burroughs wrote Naked Lunch on. And every room had a typewriter. And every typewriter had been used by Burroughs or Kerouac or Ginsberg. And there'd be pictures on the wall of the rooms at the Beat Hotel where Ginsberg wrote Howl, or Corso wrote, you know, wrote his great pieces. And all the rooms were basically a museum. And in the main room, there was all the shotgun art. And Steve had an amazing collection of a lot of paintings from Burroughs and a lot of signed hardback classics. And it really was a Beat museum more than anything. But it was just a great place to go to get away. And if you wanted to go somewhere and be creative, that place was really just, it was electrical. Mm-hmm. It was incredible. And in front of it was this huge trailer, this huge gold trailer that Steve said was the trailer that was used for the Long, Long Trailer in the movie, The Long, Long Trailer, with Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball, directed by Vincent Minnelli. And so when I got there, I saw the trailer, and I just said, you know, I have to have my picture taken in that doorway of that trailer with the black bikini on and high heels. And we were checking out. I think it was New Year's Day, 2006, and I said, oh, no, we're supposed to do that photo session. And I said, you know, let's just do it next time. And then about 10 minutes later, I said, you know what, let's just do it now. So we went downstairs, I stood in the doorway in my bikini, and it was 12 noon, broad daylight, and my then boyfriend at the time and photographer, he said, take your bikini off. Take off your clothes. And I was like, are you kidding? Just do it. Just do it. And I'm like, we're on a main highway, Hacienda Avenue. Are you crazy? He said, go ahead, do it, Iris. Doesn't matter. No one's even going to see. Well, that wasn't exactly the case. But I said, you know what? I'm going to do this. So I did it, and that's how we got that photo that I like a lot.
Yeah, it's a really cool. And to know what the deal is with those typewriters. And yeah, we're just about out of time, Iris. I'd love to talk to you for another hour.
Let me just say that 20 days later, the owner of the motel passed away, Steve Lowe. So it was pretty great that we got that photo.
Yeah, so the timing and everything took on a lot of meaning that way. But I want to make sure you had a chance to mention anything else you wanted to let us know about before we got to close out.
The next issue of Slake number 4, is going to be featuring a story that I wrote about Art Kunkin, the founder of the Los Angeles Free Press.
Okay.
And if you wanted to get those Tropicana excerpts, that's in Slake issue number 1. And Slake also has a page on Facebook.
Okay, that's Slake, S-L-A-K-E. And again, your web address or Facebook, give us out some of those URLs.
It's you know, Facebook, Iris Berry 5, that's my personal page. And then the writer page is Iris Berry. There's Notes from a Punk Rock Crash Pad. That's on Facebook. That's a like page. There's Punk Hostage Press, also a like page. And How Dirty Girls Get Clean is also a like page on Facebook.
Okay, Iris Berry, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. Loved talking to you about all of this. Great work, really inspiring and moving, and, you know, it's keep up the good work.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Really, thank you.
Okay, be talking to you soon.
Okay, Robert.
All right.
Take care.
And that wraps it up there with Iris Berry, and that is pretty much the end of Out the Rabbit Hole here. I believe we have Matt Kaplan coming up in just about 2 minutes for the usual Thursday early evening fare, and that is Counterspin and Planetary Radio, which you will like. And I'll remind you once more, the opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the KUCI staff or management or the UC Board of Regents. And if you want to give me some feedback on the show, you can email me at rglarson@kuci.org. You can also catch me on Facebook. That's facebook.com/rglarson. Okay, this is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Robert Larson, and I'll be talking to you next week.